Good morning, this is AM, I'm Chris Yuleman. The future of the plan to deregulate Australian universities is uncertain. The Abbott government wants the package of bills through the Senate this week, but so far it doesn't have the numbers. Independent Tasmanian Senator Jackie Lambie has denounced the bill as unfair and pleaded with her fellow crossbencher Ricky Muir to think about its effect on working class children. And last night, Labor blindsided the government with a Senate manoeuvre that leaves it with a new dilemma. Political correspondent Louise Yaxley reports.
The government's continuing to negotiate with crossbenchers, but Senator Lambie's not impressed with the Education Minister, Christopher Pyne.
The haste in which the current Education Minister is pushing this deal reminds me of a dodgy used car salesman trying to flog a lemon in Sydney's western suburbs. And I'm not buying it.
The numbers are tight, with crossbenchers still being lobbied. She says her fellow crossbencher Ricky Muir's decision could be crucial, and she urges him to think carefully.
I ask that before Ricky votes, that Ricky consider the tens of thousands of children who come from working class backgrounds, who will never be given the opportunity to better themselves and improve their lot in life through a university education because of the Liberals' cost will scare them and stop them from even dreaming of a uni degree. This legislation is deliberately designed to keep working class people in their place by Liberals who think they are born to rule and lord over normal Australians.
Liberal Senator Corey Bernardi rejected that view.
That I support this bill, not because I am part of the landed gentry seeking to oppress the working class or to stop the impoverished from receiving an education. Such nonsense doesn't reflect any of the facts within this bill.
The government doesn't have the numbers at the moment to get the uni changes through, so it adjourned debate on them last night. And as soon as that happened, Labor's Stephen Conroy blindsided the government with a procedural manoeuvre. He brought on a government bill to get rid of red tape, but added a clause insisting on an open tender process for buying new submarines.
So that our new submarine fleet cannot be built without a competitive tender process.
Senator Conroy's tactic was to put pressure on South Australian Liberals who've been calling for the subs to be built in their home state.
So you've said this is what you believe should happen. Well, now is the chance for you to prove that what you've been saying is what you're going to do.
The manager of government business, Mitch Fifield, was furious about what he called a stunt.
One of the most blatant and significant breaches of faith that I have seen in this place in my 10 years. It is one of the most appalling things I have seen.
The Greens and all but two of the crossbenchers backed Labor, and now the government can't return to its higher education plan until this has been dealt with. Then the government's red tape removal bill will be sent back to the lower house with that awkward new section on a submarine tender attached. It's not clear when debate will resume on higher education or how much Senate success the government will have this week. Greens Senator Lee Rhiannon paints a bleak picture.
The government has had one day of the 4 days of sittings. No bills have been passed 3 days ago. Maybe about 20 bills they're trying to push through.
Greens Senator Lee Rhiannon ending that report from political correspondent Louise Yaxley. Well, if the government is to get its higher education blueprint through the Senate, then it needs the support of six of the eight crossbenchers. One of them is John Madigan, an independent senator. Good morning.
Morning, Chris.
Now, John Madigan, the core of the government's higher education plan is the idea that universities should be allowed to set their own fees. Is that an idea that you support?
Look, Chris, I don't believe the package is perfect. You know, I'd like to think there was another way, but, you know, I've listened to more universities, more vice chancellors. I've had the unions, I've had lobby groups, I've had students, I've had current academics, retired academics, people from, you know, medium, small-sized businesses. I've held meeting after meeting in my office listening to people, and you know, there seems to be a consensus amongst many people, the vast majority of people, that there needs to be some reform of what's there. Now, is this package perfect? Nothing's perfect. But, you know, I'm not hearing you know, people are saying, look, you know, don't vote for it, just knock it out. Well, we're here to look at things. The government's put up a package, whether it will get through or not, whether we'll get to a vote. It's all crystal ball gazing at the moment.
Certainly is. But that core idea, though, that's the thing the government wants to get up, the deregulation of university fees. So in the end, is that an idea you would support? Because in the end, the other parts of it are perhaps bells and whistles.
Well, look, you know, as I said, I'm not a great fan of it, but, you know, I've put forward things that I think, 5 points, where I think, you know, that are, well, you know, really are not negotiable. And I'm very keen to hear what other alternatives people have to what's being proposed by the government. You know, there are problems. And successive governments of both persuasions have stripped out of education enormous amounts of money. And I don't see that it's not going to continue to happen. You know, different governments package things up in different ways. And universities, and more importantly, students need some certainty.
All right. Well, in certainty, we can't be certain about what happens in the Senate. It is a bit of crystal ball gazing, but do you think there are the numbers to get something approaching this plan sorted this week?
On the face of it, last night, you know, when I went home, I'd say no. But, you know, who knows in this place? Things shift very quickly. Sometimes, and then other times things, you know, are very, very slow.
What do you think about senators who attach what they'd call boondoggles in the United States to every single Senate bill? Jackie Lambie now won't support any bill until she gets what she wants on ADF pay. David Leinhelm is threatening to vote against this government legislation unless he's given a guarantee that his same-sex marriage bill will be debated in the coalition party room. What do you think about that?
I don't believe in bludgeoning people. I don't think that you achieve anything by smacking people around the head. You only harden their resolve and close them off to any discussion. The fact of the matter is, as crossbench senators and people, you know, in that balance of power mix comes a great responsibility. Senator Lambie is entitled to have a viewpoint, as is Senator Laneholm. But it's a steep learning curve when you come here. They've all been, you know, the new crossbench has only been here 5 months. And I think that we need to...
It might be a steep learning curve, but what about acting in good faith? Would you say that the Palmer United Party has acted in good faith in the way that it's dealt with the Senate, for example?
Well, you know, when the government thought they had the numbers with, you know, the Palmer United Party bloc in the past, you know, a lot of us didn't know what way things were going to go, other crossbench senators... till the morning of. Deals were done, we weren't consulted. The best way for the to deal with things, I think, is for people, one, to be up front and to be straight. You can have your points of view, but play with a straight bat. Tell the truth. And that applies to the government and the opposition.
And to Clive Palmer?
Well, you know, look, I can't speak for Mr. Palmer. All I can say is that a lot of us weren't aware of anything that was going on. We weren't included. And, you know, it doesn't make for good policy making. I think, you know, if you get all the opinions in the pot, you might come out with better results. But deals were done. You know, he had the whip handle at that stage, but as we all know, that has changed.
Do you get concerned that, obviously, when you get to... any vote, if Labor and the Coalition vote together, then they would pass everything. But are you concerned that you will be lumped in with a group of senators that are seen as essentially obstructive?
Well, look, you know, of course, for some people's, you know, way of thinking, that you know, they'll do whatever they want to do. But, you know, I'm not a rubber stamp for anybody. You know, I'm at pains to look at things in a quiet, calm, consistent manner. I actually listen to people, my door's open, whether it's in my office at home, Ballarat, or here in Canberra, and I've never knocked people back.
Well, John Madigan, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
And that is Independent Senator John Madigan. You're listening to AM Around Australia. It's 20 minutes past 7. And stay with us because ahead, a new plan to try and stop Australian girls from becoming child brides. It sounds like good news for oil importing countries like Australia. The falling price of crude should mean cheaper prices at the bowser, lower transport costs, food prices could fall. It's effectively a nationwide tax cut. But for some of the oil exporting nations, it's a financial disaster. In Russia, it's estimated the falling prices have already costed $100 billion. And the toll is rising, as Europe correspondent Philip Williams reports.
With the economic sanctions imposed on Russia over Ukraine, the decline in oil prices couldn't have come at a worse time. The price of this global commodity has declined nearly 40% this year, below the cost of production in some countries, including Russia. And while the oil pumps keep the black magic flowing there, the rivers of revenue gold in reverse have been reduced to streams. And as the price goes down, so too does the Russian ruble, which has declined by around 40% this year, all of which could spell deep economic and political trouble. Professor Paul Stevens is an energy and resources specialist at London's Chatham House.
As the price falls, of course, revenue falls, which means that the budget deficit in Russia is going to get larger and larger. And because of sanctions, Russia's not really able to go into capital markets to borrow money, so they're going to be in serious trouble.
Russia's central bank spent, some say wasted, billions defending the currency's value to no avail. Overnight, the ruble hit a fresh low against the US dollar in the biggest one-day fall since the Russian currency crisis of 1998. Speaking a few days ago, a surprisingly sanguine Russian President Vladimir Putin said he expected by the middle of next year the price would restore its balance, in other words, go up. But despite controlling vast supplies of oil and gas, Mr. Putin can't do much about it on his own. OPEC, the oil-producing cartel, decided last week to keep the supplies at current levels, and with slow to no growth in the global economy, demand has disappeared. Dr. David Cardia is an international relations expert at the London School of Economics.
If the energy prices are down, if oil prices are so low, then the economic situation in Russia would be affected. And in other words, he won't be able to bring this economic development that he was able to since the oil boom.
Ultimately, is this a threat to his position in power?
It is. I believe it is. A decrease of oil prices might actually lead to a more nationalist Russian foreign policy, but it also means that Vladimir Putin's personal power might be threatened.
And that, says Dr. David Cardia, would mean Vladimir Putin might need a diversion, like greater intervention in Ukraine or some other action that would appeal to the high level of nationalist fervour that he has cultivated. Cheap oil might seem like a great idea, but the consequences in places like Russia are difficult and dangerous to predict. This is Philip Williams in London, reporting for AM.
The Child Abuse Royal Commission will open its 21st case study this morning, focused on the Mangrove Mountain Yoga Ashram in the hinterland of the New South Wales Central Coast. It'll examine allegations involving the ashram's former spiritual leader in the 1970s and 80s. The charismatic and influential guru of the New Age spiritual community was charged with more than 35 sex offences against four teenage girls. He was jailed in 1989, but his conviction was overturned just 2 years later. Emily Burke reports.
The Mangrove Mountain Yoga Ashram advertises itself as the largest yoga retreat centre in the Southern Hemisphere. It's been a teaching centre for nearly four decades, but there's a dark cloud over its early years. And now it's the first non-mainstream organisation to come under the glare of the National Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse. One of the founders of the centre, Swami Akadananda Saraswati, was charged in the late 1980s with sexually abusing teenage girls while they were residing at the ashram. Alicia Buchanan was among them.
I am expecting and hoping that there is a very bright light shone on this particular ashram, and then I hope over time others and all the related properties and organisations that are affiliated with the ashram, because the ashram is a place that has operated very much in shadow for a very long time, and I really, for me, would like to see there's lights shone into the more the dark corners.
Swami Saraswati was tried, found guilty and served 14 months in prison, but a successful appeal before the High Court saw those convictions quashed. Alicia Buchanan again.
I felt that I've been victimised all over again. I felt that I didn't matter to overturn any convictions against him. It just felt to me like that I was being erased from the story.
The Royal Commission's investigation will examine how the ashram responded between 1974 and this year to allegations or reports of child sexual abuse made against Swami Saraswati, who died in 1997. It will also examine the operation of the ashram, the systems, policies and procedures in place between the 1970s and 80s. Lawyer Aaron Kernaghan is representing the ashram.
They've indicated to me that they wish to acknowledge what has happened, and of course, their deep regret for what has happened. That may not be much solace to the people that it happened to, but an apology is a very complicated thing, and the giving of it is a process of not just giving to victims an acknowledgement, but demonstrating your own desire to acknowledge a responsibility and be very contemporary and forward-thinking in how to deal with people who have been the victims of sexual assault.
And what about avenues for redress or compensation?
Those avenues are open to anyone to approach the ashram. My clients haven't had that approach at this point, but they're expecting it, and they've made a commitment to do what they can, so far as they're able, to answer those requests.
The public hearing is expected to run until the end of next week.
Emily Burke. A women's health service says it's been told a 9-year-old Sydney girl has left the country to be married overseas. Community leaders say similar cases are being hidden from authorities because families fear prosecution. Today, the Abbott government is launching a new arranged marriage safety plan to encourage young women to speak up if they're being forced to marry. But a leading women's rights campaigner says the strategy won't work because girls are too scared to implicate their families. Bridget Brennan reports.
The Immigrant Women's Health Service in Western Sydney says it received a tip-off yesterday about a case involving a 9-year-old child bride. The service spoke to the girl's mother but says it couldn't get specific information, but it suspected the girl will be married in the Middle East. AM can't confirm the claims. Dr. Iman Sharabim is the director of the health service.
There was a conflicted story between the child and what the parents said, and of course the story had been sent to the service, to Immigrant Women's Health Service, and unfortunately we can't do anything because the girl already travelled overseas.
The girl's case isn't an isolated one. The Immigrant Women's Health Service has heard of a dozen other cases since June. The Federal Justice Minister, Michael Keenan, says it's hard to know exactly how many Australian girls are being forced into marriages because most cases are kept secret.
We're very keen to find out the extent of it within the community and to make sure that if somebody is to come across this type of crime, that they know how to go about helping that person to report it to authorities so we can do something about it.
Today, the Minister is launching a new safety action plan brochure for women and girls in or at risk of a forced marriage.
We're making sure that we have materials out there that educate the community about what to look for, and so these crimes can be reported and then the appropriate authorities can go and prosecute them.
But Iman Sharabim is sceptical. She says girls being forced into marriage contracts don't want their parents to face criminal charges.
I already tried with many of them to talk to them about informing the authority, and as soon as I even put that on the table, the girls actually turned their back and say, we're not even going to have a conversation with you.
Iman Sharabim says the government's new strategy needs to put more resources towards grassroots education campaigns if it's to have any success. She says the girls need to learn how to speak to their families.
Teach us how to talk to our parents, because our own mother wants to send us to a man which we don't know. These are some of the words I heard from these girls, and it break my heart, to be honest. It break my heart to see that we're trying all our best to save lives, and yet the government is printing glossy papers.
Dr. Iman Sharabim, the director of the Immigrant Women's Health Service. Bridget Brennan was our reporter. To finance, and Wall Street is 0.1% lower after Thanksgiving holiday spending in America slowed and measures of manufacturing in China and Germany dropped. The biggest drag came from Apple, which plunged 3% at one point on concerns about weaker consumer demand around the world. The Australian dollar is a little stronger ahead of today's meeting at the Reserve Bank Board. It's buying 85.15 $0.0005, and it's buying 68.18 euro cents. I'm Chris Yeoman. That's AM for today.